the slightest sweet apple scent of perfume. He ran a hand through the gentle curls of her hair and sighed.
Assholes! I'd work for free for any chance to be near you. They're offering a fortune, and I'd throw it in the Amethyll for this.
Locke, she whispered, indulge me.
Oh?
Kiss me.
With every...
No, not like that. My preferred way. You know what I mean. From back when we were...
Ah, he said, laughing. Your servant, madam.
Sabitha had always had a peculiar ticklish weakness, something he'd discovered by accident when they'd first become lovers so many years before. He gently placed his left hand beneath her chin and tilted her head back, then planted his lips high up on the side of her neck, beneath her ear. The way she moved in his arms instantly folded his better judgment up and hid it away in a deep, dark place.
So this is what you really brought me here for?
Keep going, she said breathlessly, and we'll find out.
He kissed her several more times, and when he felt he'd teased her enough, ran his tongue up and down those same few inches of warm skin. She actually gasped and clutched him more tightly still.
Oh, dear,
he said, laughing and smacking his lips. He swallowed several times to clear a curious dry taste from his tongue.
Your perfume, I seem to have removed some of it. I hope it wasn't expensive.
A special formulation, just for you, she whispered.
She continued to cling to him, digging her hands into his shoulders, and for one more moment Locke was at peace with the entire world. The numbness began at the edge of his tongue, and in a few seconds it spread, tingling, around his mouth and up to the tip of his nose.
No!
he whispered, hit as hard by shock as he was by whatever he'd just swallowed. He tried to pull away, but she was too strong for him. His limbs were already taking on a curious foggy dissociation.
No! No!
Sabitha whispered, no longer shuddering, no longer breathless with shared anticipation.
A special formulation. Throat and voice go first. Just relax. Jean can't hear you.
What? My?
Forgive me, she said.
She cradled him as his legs turned to jelly. She knelt slowly, bringing him down with her, laying him across her knees.
I wasn't sure whether I'd really do it or not. If it's any consolation, your story about Tal Verar was the convincer. You're not as good as I am, Locke, but you're too damn good to let you run around fighting fairly. I have to beat you, for both our sakes. Don't talk, just listen. You don't have much time left. There's a second reason. I can see now how ill you've been, and how you'll have to push yourself to keep up with me. I can't let you do it, Locke. I can't watch you do it. You'll kill yourself trying to best me, and you can't ask me to permit that. Not when I could stop it. I once cared for you a great deal. I care for you now. Remember that.
She kissed him gently on the forehead, and he barely felt it.
Remember that, and forgive me.
9. Said Locke, coming up from layers of blackness that seemed draped over him like burial shrouds.
Sab, no, please.
He gasped, with the disbelieving gratitude of someone finally fighting back to wakefulness after an interminable nightmare of suffocation. He smelled his own sweat and the familiar odors of wet wood and fresh lake air. His eyes slid grudgingly open. He was lying on his back in yet another ship's great cabin, this one more luxuriously appointed than any he'd ever seen, even Zamira Drakasha's. Soft orange alchemical globes cast the fixtures and finery in an inviting light. Gulls cried somewhere nearby, and the world creaked gently around him.
Stupid, stupid, stupid,
muttered Locke, reveling in the full recovery of his powers of speech. He sat up and instantly became aware of the fierce gnawing hunger in his belly.
Oh, stupid, stupid, stupid! You can't blame yourself, said Jean.
Locke turned to see him sitting against the opposite wall on a hanging bed furnished with embroidered sheets. Jean had fresh bruises on his bare forearms and around his eyes. "Gods," said Locke, "what the hell happened to you?" "Remember how she joked about 20 armed people in the next room?" said Jean with a sigh. He set down the book he'd been reading. "There were 20 armed men in the next room." "Fuck me sideways with hot peppers and a pinch of salt," said Locke. "How long have I been out?"
"Half a day."
"Where are we?"
"On the Amethyl, headed west, bound for the sea."
"Are you kidding?"
Jean pointed at something behind Locke, and Locke turned. The rear windows of the cabin, which were open to let in a view of a grey morning over blue water, were girded with a network of thick iron bars on their outer surface. The gaps in the bars were too small for even Locke to contemplate wiggling through.
"She's put us on quite a luxurious prison ship," said Jean. "We're the only passengers, and we're chartered for a nice slow voyage out to sea and around the continent."
"Are you fucking kidding?"
"If all goes as she planned, we'll get back to Carthay in a week or two after all the votes have been counted."
Intersect 2. Tinder.
"I have to tell you, we're not terribly impressed with your boys so far."
"We thought they did very well, up to their meeting with your exemplar."
"It's that meeting with our exemplar that inspires a certain lack of foreboding on our part."
"They'll be back soon enough."
"They're headed out to sea in irons."
"You know who else thought lightly of them once? The Falconer."
"Very amusing."
"Interesting things are going to be happening around Lamora, my friend. Just keep your attention focused very closely on him at all times."
Interlude. The Moncrane Company. 1.
"He's been arrested for punching a nobleman?" said Locke.
"Hauled off in irons," said Janora.
"Of all the gods damned... How bad is that here? They're not going to hang him, are they?"
"Dungeon for a year and a day," said Alondo. "Then he loses the offending hand."
"I suppose Moncrane's lucky he didn't kick the fellow," said Jean.
"Certainly he's lucky," said Sylvanus, looking up from his bottle. "He's in the one place in the city where his creditors can't skin his balls and salt them. They should let us keep the hand when they chop it off. Embalm it with tar. Make a damn fine prop, especially when I play a Thorma magic person."
"How do we get him back?" said Sabatha.
"Back?"
said a woman who appeared out of the shadows behind Alondo and Janora. Approaching middle age, she was well-muscled and stout, with mahogany skin and hair grey as wood ash.
"Why would anyone want Jasmer Moncrane back, having so easily gotten rid of him? And why are there strangers in my inn-yard?"
"I imagine they're called customers, auntie," said Janora. "You do remember when they used to come voluntarily?"
"Yes, I'm an attentive student of ancient history," said the older woman. "Alisana Gloriano, proprietor and semi-professional martyr at your service. Are you really looking for Jasmer Moncrane?"
"He's our employer," said Sabatha. "Or at least he's meant to be."
"My gods above," said Mistress Gloriano, putting her arms around the shoulders of Alondo and Janora. "The Camorri! They're real!"
"We're as shocked as you, auntie," said Janora.
"It's pleasant to be thought of as such freakish wonders," said Locke, "but we need to reach Moncrane."
"Well then," said Mistress Gloriano, "all you need to do is wait for his conviction the day after tomorrow.
Then wait another year and a day, and then stand outside the Weeping Tower. He'll be the one coming out with his right hand missing."
"What about a solicitor?"
"We don't exactly retain one," said Alondo.
"Tell us what we can do, then," said Locke. "Can we see him?"
"Oh, yes, dear boy," said Sylvanus. "Inquire after the nearest gentleman or lady of high birth and smash him across the teeth. You could end up sharing Jasmus' cell."
"Damn it," said Locke. "No offence, but the four of you sound like you'd just as soon slit Moncrane's throat as give him the time of day. Is there a Moncrane company at all? Are you putting on a play this summer? Our situation requires that we be employed, so for Perelandro's sake, be clear."
"'We're still a company,' said Janora, "'though we've had some defections. "'Alondo, Sylvanus, and Jasmer are the remaining full players. "'One or two more might come back if Jasmer could show his face in public.'
"'You're not an actress,' said Jean.
"'Stage mistress,' said Janora. "'Costumes, scenery, props. "'If it doesn't walk around on its own legs, it's my business. "'And assuming,' said Locke, "'that a miracle occurred and the gods themselves transported Moncrane out of jail, "'would we have work for the summer?'
"'We've lost some rehearsal time,' said Sylvanus, "'easing himself onto his back with a sigh.
"'That sounds like a hint at a yes,' said Locke. "'The real problem is money,' said Mistress Gloriano. "'I invested in Moncrane 2 years ago for my niece's sake, "'and he's still down to me for 12 royals, "'and I'm the least troublesome of those he's bound to. "'Money troubles can be finessed,' said Locke.
"'There's no credit to be had,' said Alondo. "'None of us can buy so much as a grain of rice on a promise. "'We can find scut work to stay fed, "'or even do morality plays in the streets, "'but the company has no funds.' "'For scribing, for costumes, masks, lights. "'And we have no venue, nor transport to it,' said Janora. "'There's 2 rooms of old props and clothes we can work with, all stored here, "'but we'll make a laughing-stock of ourselves if we're seen hauling it around on foot.'
"'More of a laughing-stock,' muttered Alondo.
"'We have a wagon,' said Locke. "'Give us a moment.'
"'He pulled Jean and Sabatha away from the tattered remnants of the Moncrane Company.'
"'That's a lot of our money sewn up in the wagon and horses,' said Jean.
"'I know,' said Locke. "'What if we sold 2 horses and kept the other pair? "'Taking care of them is going to use up more time and money we hadn't planned on spending,' said Sabatha.
"'Yeah,' said Locke. "'But if we can't get this troop back to work, we might as well turn around and roll straight back to Camor. "'If that's the plan, I'm sure as hell going to develop a speech impediment when we explain things to chains.'
"'Hardly our fault Moncrane punched us well,' said Jean.
"'Chains will expect more from us than a quick sniff around before we give up,' said Sabatha. "'We were sent here expressly to restore Moncrane's fortunes. "'We've got to pry him out of this mess somehow.'
"'And what if we can't?' said Jean softly.
"'Then at least we tried,' said Locke. "'Sabatha's right. "'It's one thing to go home with our options exhausted. "'It's another to fold at the first sign of trouble.'
"'We'll need more money,' said Sabatha. "'I don't see much chance of any thoughtful schemes just yet, "'but pockets are pockets and purses are purses. "'If we—'
"'No,' said Locke. "'We can't be thieves, remember? "'We've got more trouble than we bargained for "'just pretending to be actors.'
"'The expression on Sabatha's face was so dangerous "'that Locke became aware of it, like the heat from an oil lamp, "'before he even turned to see it. "'He put his hands up, palms out.'
"'Sabatha, I know what you're thinking. "'I've been dwelling on what you said, believe me. "'I can't insist that you follow my orders, "'but I am asking you to consider my points "'and let me convince you.'
"'Her expression softened.
"'Maybe there's hope for you after all,' she said. "'So make your case.' "'We don't know this place,' said Locke. "'We don't know the constables, the gangs, or the hiding places.' What would we think of some asshole from the Outlands trying to come at the slick coat teaser back in Camor? We'd laugh at the yokel and watch him hang. Well, in Espara, we're the yokels, and if we make a mistake, there's no secret piece to fall back on. It's not that we might not need to clutch and tease a bit, he continued. Just not yet, not until we've learned our way around.
I see your point, she said. In fact, I'm sure you're right. Maybe I'm a little too used to the conveniences of home.
She put out her hand, and Locke, after a moment, smiled and shook it firmly.
"'Who the hell are you people?' said Locke. "'And where did you get those excellent Locke and Sabatha disguises?'
"'Quit gaping, Jean. Let's move fast,' said Sabatha sweetly. "'We need horses sold, horses stabled, Moncrane freed, money changed, and rooms. "'And that's just off the top of my head.'
"'Mistress Gloriano!' Locke yelled, turning back toward her. "'We don't mean to put you to any trouble, but we need rooms in a hurry so we can unload our wagon.
"'You're really staying, then?'
"'Of course,' said Locke, "'and keep a tab separate from the rest of the company. "'We'll pay actual money.'
"'For a few days, at least,' he thought.
"'Well,' said Mistress Gloriano, as though coming out of a trance, "'I've no shortage of rooms.' "Giacomo!" shouted Sabitha. "Castellano!"
Carlo and Galdo came at a near run and skidded to a halt in front of Sylvanus.
"These are the Asino brothers," said Sabitha. "You two, find out where Mistress Gloriano's putting us, and get our things heaved out of the wagon as quick as you can."
"What, first were the bloody wagon guards, now we're fucking stevedores?" said Carlo. "You want a foot massage and some chilled wine while you watch us work?"
"We've all got jobs," said Sabitha, "and if you touch my feet, I'll cut your ears off. Move!"
The next 15 minutes were a blur of activity for everyone except Sylvanus, for whom they were merely a blur. Jean took a moment to pitch a little tent over the prostrate actor using the wagon tarp and some sticks, and then the gentleman bastards heaved their possessions into two rooms selected by Mistress Gloriano. These were fine examples of how middle age, while charming in some humans, is less endearing in wood panel construction and unpreserved wall tapestries. The twins claimed one room, Locke and Jean the other, and Sabitha accepted Genora's invitation to share her room down the corridor. Once the wagon was emptied, Jean selected the less healthy pair of horses and with Genora's aid got them stabled. Alondo claimed to have a cousin working as a hostler near the Jalan gate, so Jean enlisted the young actor to help walk the best two horses back to the caravan staging area for resale.
"Now," Locke said to Mistress Gloriano, "we need Jasmer back. For that I think we'll need a solicitor."
"I suppose it can't be helped," she said. "I've given Jasmer so much slack these past few years in the hope my investment might find its way home again."
"Let him have a bit more," said Locke. "We're here now, for what it's worth, and we need a Moncrane play. There's no work for us back home."
"I had wondered at the nature of your devotion. Jasmer's a Siresti, you know. Capricious and moody, barely reliable. Not an even-tempered Ocanti like myself or Genora. Let me tell you, boy, if I knew then what a hole I'd be throwing my money down."
"Yes, I'm sure you're quite right," said Locke, in a placating tone of voice. "But a solicitor?"
"There is a fellow," said Mistress Gloriano. "Back up the avenue the way you came. Stay Awake Salvard, he's called, on account of his peculiar hours. He's done papers for me. I wouldn't go so far as to accuse him of being a gentleman. Works for a lot of colourful sorts."
"That's good," said Locke.
"That's great. We're colourful sorts."
2.
"Etienne Deloncart Domingo Salvard," said Sabitha, reading out loud from the lantern-lit plaque beside the building's street entrance. "Master solicitor, bonded law scribe, authorized notary, executor of wills and estates, Vadran translator and transcriber. Fortunes assured, justice delivered, enemies confounded. Reasonable rates."
Locke and Sabitha alone had come on this errand, after washing the smell of the road from their more accessible parts and swapping their filthy caravan clothes for less offensive outfits. Salvard's office was perched on the edge of the increasing desolation that led to Solace Hill, a way station between the couth and uncouth districts of the city. The comfortless wooden furniture and empty walls inside seemed, to Locke's eye, to indicate a certain desire to avoid giving rowdy clientele any objects for vandalism. A thin man with slicked-back hair sat behind a little podium, and near the stairs on the far side of the room lounged an uncommonly large woman. Her quilted black tunic had obvious armour panels behind the facing.
"Evening," said the thin man. "Appointment?"
"Do we really need one?" said Sabitha. "We're on urgent business."
"2 coppins consultation fee," said the thin man, "plus one for expedited consideration."
"We're just in from Camor," said Locke. "We haven't changed our money yet."
"Camori barons accepted," said the thin man. "One for one basis, plus one for changing fee."
Locke shook 4 copper coins out of his purse. The clerk inked a quill and began scrawling on a card.
"Names?"
"Verina Galante," said Sabitha, "and Lucasa de Barra."
"Camori subjects?"
"Yes."
The clerk set down his quill, slid open a hatch in the wall behind him, placed the card within this compartment, and turned a hand crank. A miniature dumb waiter went up, and a minute later the muffled jingling of a bell could be heard from within the shaft.
"Weapons not allowed upstairs,"
said the clerk, rapping his knuckles on the surface of his podium.
"Cheerfully guarded here. Arms out for search."
The big woman gave them both a thorough pat-down. A garrote or a fruit-paring blade might have slipped through, but Etienne Deloncard Domingo Salvard clearly had strong feelings about allowing anything more conveniently deadly into his presence.
"They're clean," said the woman, with a half-smile. "Of weapons, that is."
"Proceed," said the clerk, pointing to the stairs. "Pleasant consultation."
Stay awake, Salvard sat behind a desk that completely bisected the floor of his office, ensuring that anyone attempting to leap at him would have one final obstacle to surmount while he escaped or armed himself. Locke wondered if it was the nature of his clients or the quality of his advice that had made him such a cautious fellow.
"Have a seat. You two are a bit young to be caught up in the grasping tentacles of the law, aren't you?"
Salvard was a wiry man in his 40s with a leonine mane of greying hair, swept back as though he'd just spent 20 minutes on a galloping horse. His nose was built to support the weight of optics much heavier than the dainty piece actually perched there. Two pipes rested in wooden cradles on his cluttered desk, framing him in grey pillars of aromatic smoke.
"Or is it some matter of a marriage, perhaps?"
"Certainly not," said Sabitha. "We have a friend in trouble."
"Supply the details."
"He struck a gentleman above his station," said Sabitha.
"Is your friend taken, or has he fled?"
"They put him in something called the Weeping Tower," said Locke.
"Tricky. I'm afraid the weight of the law is against him, and he should expect to be trimmed like a hedge," said Salvard. "But these incidents can sometimes be portrayed in a sympathetic light. What else should I know?"
"He's a bit of a drunkard," said Locke.
"Many of my clients have crawled inside a bottle for solace. It's no unusual challenge."
"And he's a member of a night-skinned race," said Locke. "A black Siresti."
"A noble people, as ancient as our own, with many admirers at court."
"Our friend is next to penniless."
"Yet obviously he has allies," said Salvard warmly, extending his arms toward Locke and Sabitha. "Who can be relied upon to take up his interests? My fee schedules are quite elastic. Anything else?"
"He's the owner and manager of a theatrical troupe."
Salvard lost his smile. He took a long pull on his left-hand pipe, set it down, then smoked its counterpart. He alternated pipes several times, staring at Locke and Sabitha. Finally he said,
"So, we're talking about Jasmer Moncrane, then."
"You know him?" said Locke.
"I should have guessed his identity sooner from the particulars, save for the fact that you genuinely seemed to want him back. That put me off the true scent. What's your interest in his cause?"
"We're actors engaged by him for the summer," said Sabitha. "We've only just arrived in the city."
"My condolences. I have one piece of relevant advice."
"Anything," said Sabitha.
"Many men in low trades adapt to the loss of a hand and wear hooks. In Jasmer's case, his vanity will never allow it. If you're still in Espara next summer as his stump heals, get him a simple leather cap for it and—"
"We need him back now," said Sabitha. "We need him out of custody."
"Well, you won't get him. Not through the workings of anyone in my profession." Now, my dear, it pains me to see that look on your face as much as it pains me to refuse work. So let me explain. My happy fortune is your hard luck. You must have heard of Emilio Basanti."
"Actually, no," said Locke.
"You truly are fresh off the wagon, aren't you? Basanti is the impresario of the city's other major company of actors, the stable and successful one. In a fortnight, Demoiselle Ameline Basanti, his youngest sister, will become Mistress Ameline Salvard."
"Oh," said Sabitha.
"If I were to become an advocate for the very rival my future brother by bonding loathes so famously, well, surely you can see that the effect upon my marital relations could only be chilling."
"Can you recommend someone who wouldn't be at cross-purposes?" said Locke.
"There are 5 other solicitors at law in Aspara," said Salvard, "and none of them will touch the case. You must understand, if I weren't taking a bribe, I'd argue it for pleasure. I enjoy annoying magistrates, and I handle even the lowest and most difficult clients. No offense. My peers, however, prefer to win their cases, and this one cannot be won."
"But those excuses you just came up with..."
"Could mitigate the situation, perhaps. Surely you understand that those of elevated blood don't keep laws on the books that would require them to take abuse from their inferiors. I wouldn't cite law. I'd beg for mercy. I'd spin yarns about destitute friends and children. But since I'm not going to do those things, Moncrain's trial will last about as long as this conversation."
"Do we have any other options?" said Locke.
"Apply to Basanti's troop," said Salvard gently. "At the Columbine's Petal, up in Greyside. That's where they drink. I could mention you to Emmeline. They'd find work for you, even if it's just carrying spears. Don't tie yourselves to Moncrain."
"That's kind of you," said Sabatha. "But if we'd wanted to be part of the scenery, we could have stayed at home. In Moncrain's company, we can have our pick of roles. In a settled troop, we'll be at the end of a long line." Salvard again smoked his pipes in alternating fashion, then rubbed his eyes.
"I suppose I can't fault ambition, even if it's bound to end in tears. But there's no way Moncrain's slipping the hook, children. Not unless one of 2 miracles occurs."
"Miracles," said Locke. "We're in the market for those. What are they?"
"First, Countess Antonia could issue a pardon. She can do anything she pleases, but she won't save him. Moncrain's far from her good graces. Anyway, she's more interested in the advice of her wine steward than her privy council these days."
"What else?" said Locke.
"The noble that Moncrain attacked could grant a personal pardon by declining to make a complaint before a magistrate. The case would be dismissed. However, I'm sure you can imagine how keen blue bloods are to show weakness in front of their peers."
"Yeah," said Locke. "Hells. Can we even talk to Moncrain?"
"There I can offer some cheer," said Salvard. "Anyone with a blood or trade connection to a prisoner can have 1 audience before a trial. Claim it whenever you like, just don't try to give him anything. You'll share his sentence if you're caught."
"An audience," said Locke. "Good. Where?"
"At the heart of Aspara, atop the Legion's steps, look for the black stone tower with the moat and the 100 terribly serious guards. Can't miss it, even in the rain."
3. 1,000 dead soldiers loomed out of the mist beneath the gathering night as Locke and Sabatha climbed the heights of the Legion steps. The marble marchers, cracked and weathered from their vigil of 600 years, wore the armor of Therin-throne legionnaires. Locke recognized the costume from paintings and manuscripts he'd seen in Camor. He even recalled a bit of their story, that some emperor or another, dissatisfied with Aspara's lack of prominent elderglass monuments, had commissioned a work of human art to grace the center of the city. Each statue was said to be a likeness of an actual soldier from a then-living legion, and it was part of their melancholy fascination that they were not posed in martial triumph, but with heads down and shields slung, as they might have been seen trudging along the roads that had once knit the fallen empire together. Now they marched in place, rank on rank forever, in columns evenly spread across the 200-yard arc of the stairs.
"We've got to find his accuser and arrange to have him forgiven," said Locke.
"It's the only chance we seem to have left," said Sabatha.
"Gods, I wish we had more money," said Locke. "Going visiting in society on scraps of a pittance won't be easy."
"Tempted to go back on your plan to avoid thieving?"
"Yes," said Locke. "I won't do it, though."
"Just so long as you're tempted," she said, smiling.
"Honesty doesn't suit any of us," said Locke.
"I know. Isn't it strange? I keep asking myself how people can stand to live like this."
What Salvard had called a moat around the tower of dark stone was actually more of a gaping, jagged-sided pit at least 30 feet deep, into which drainage channels were directing streams of grey water. The only way across was a covered, elevated bridge with a well-lit guardhouse for a mouth. As Locke and Sabatha approached, a quartet of guards fanned out across the entrance. Locke picked up immediately on the importance of what these guards weren't carrying. They had no batons, no pole arms. Those were weapons that could be used gently if the wielder wished. These guards carried only swords, which had a more straightforward employment.
"Stand fast!"
said a weathered woman, just shy of middle age, her neck and face thick with scars. All the guards had the look of hard service. The Weeping Tower was no joke, Locke realized. Trying to bribe or suborn one of these old hounds would be suicide.
"Name your business!"
"Good evening," said Sabatha, instantly adopting a poise that was assertive but not imperious. Locke had seen her use it before. "We're here to speak with Jasmine Moncrane."
"Moncrane's not going to be entertaining for a long time," said the guard. "What does a Camorri have to say to him?"
"We're members of the Moncrane Company, and we need to make business arrangements now that he's indisposed. Our solicitor advised us that we're entitled to one audience before his trial."
Guards, as far as Locke was concerned, watching Sabatha handle people was as good as watching any other girl in the world take off her clothes. The way she chose her words, entitled, not something meeker like allowed, and the specific mention of one audience, a signal to the guard that the rules had been researched, would be obeyed. Sabatha had asserted all their wants while giving the firmest support to the notion that she and Locke were completely enfolded in the power of the law and these guards that served it. It turned out the woman was quite pleased to let them in. Not, of course, without an embarrassing full body search, or their marks on parchment, or an inventory of their purses, or a 40-minute wait. But that was all for the best, Locke thought. Only prisoners were ever granted easy passage into a prison. 4. For the second time that day, Locke and Sabatha found themselves in a chamber cut in half by a physical barrier, but now it was bars of black iron. The audience room of the Weeping Tower had smooth stone walls and a rough stone floor, with no windows, no decorations, no furniture. The guards locked the door behind them and remained at attention in front of it. They were made to wait another few minutes before the door on the opposite side of the room slid open. Two more guards brought in a man, manacled at hands and feet, and clipped a chain to a bolt in the floor. They attached this to the prisoner's leg irons, giving him a range of movement that ended about 2 feet from the iron bars. The prisoner's guards withdrew to a position mirroring that of the ones on Locke and Sabatha's side of the room. The man in chains was tall, with skin like polished boot leather and hair scraped down to a grey shadow. He was heavy-set but not ponderous. The weight of his years and appetites seemed to have spread evenly, settled in all his joints and crevices, and there was still a hint of dangerous vitality to him. His eyes were wide and bright against the darkness of his face, and he fixed them hard on Locke and Sabatha as though blinking were somehow beneath his interest.
"An opportunity to walk down 2 flights of stairs and be chained up again," he said. "Hooray! Who the hell are you?"
"Your new actors," said Locke. "Your very surprised new actors."
"Ah!"
Moncrane's seamed jowls moved as though he'd tasted something unpleasant.
"Weren't there supposed to be 5 of you?"
"Weren't you supposed to be at liberty?" said Sabatha. "The other 3 are trying to hold your troop together at Gloriano's."
"Too bad you didn't come sooner," said Moncrane. "I'm afraid there's nothing to look forward to but packing for your return. Tell your master I appreciate the gesture."
"That's not good enough," said Locke. "We were sent here to go on stage. We were sent here to learn from you."
"You want a lesson, boy? If you find yourself being born, climb back in as quick as you can, because life's a bottomless feast of shit."
"We can get you out of here," said Sabatha.
"If you cooperate," said Locke.
"Oh, you can spring me, can you?" Moncrane
knelt and ran one manacled hand across the floor.
You have an army of about 1,000 men hidden outside the city. Let me know when they're storming the tower, so I can be sure to have my breeches on.
You know our master, said Locke, lowering his voice. You can surely guess the nature of his students.
I knew your master, said Moncrane, years ago, and I thought he was sending me actors. Is that what you are? Is that where the gods have reached down and touched your little Camorri souls, eh? Given you the gift of silver tongues?
We can act, said Sabatha.
Can you? But are you lions? There's no room for any but lions in my company.
He turned his head to the guards at his door.
Lions, aren't we, boys? Only if you don't lower your fucking voice, said one of them. You see? Lions! Can you roar, children?
On stage and off, said Sabatha coolly.
That's fascinating, because from where I'm sitting, you look about, what, 16? 17? You've certainly never been wet for anything but dreams in the night, have you? Well, you might pass on stage, love. Let your hair down and fly your tits like flags. You could certainly keep the groundlings awake. But you, he said, turning to Locke, who are you fooling? Small-boned sparrow of a lad? Got fig seeds in your sack where men should have the full fruit, eh? Do you even shave? What the hell do you mean by coming in here and trying to shove good cheer up my ass?
We're your only chance to go free, said Locke, fuming, considering saying a number of less productive things.
Go free? Why? I like it here. I'm fed, and my creditors can't reach me for at least the next year. The state of Aspara will stop at one hand. Hells, that's a bargain compared to what I might get when my markers are called in on the street.
What's the name of the noble you struck? Said Sabatha.
Why do you care? Said Moncrane. How can it possibly be of aid to you as you scurry back where you fucking came from? Keep your voice down, said one of the guards, or you'll have to be carried into court tomorrow.
You know, that might be pleasant, said Moncrane. Can we give that a try?
Jasmer, said Sabatha sharply. Look at me, you stupid ass.
Jasmer did indeed look at her.
I don't care what you think of us, she whispered. You know what kind of person our master is, what kind of organization we come from. And if you don't stop braying like a jackass, this is what's going to happen. We'll leave.
I love this plan, said Moncrane. Take this plan all the way.
You'll spend your year and a day inside this tower. Then they'll cut your god's damned hand off and throw you out the door. And do you know who'll be standing there? More Camorri than you've ever seen in your fucking life. Not just us, or the other three currently toiling on your behalf on the other side of this pimple of a city. I mean big, unreasonable, cross-eyed motherfuckers straight out of the wombs of hell, and they'll take you for a ride. Locked in a box 10 days, all the way to Camorra, sloshing in your own piss.
Now, wait a minute, said Moncrane.
You don't have any other fucking creditors, get it? We're the front of the line now. We're all you need to worry about. You made a deal with our garista. You know what that word means?
Of course.
Obviously you don't. Our master sent you 5 of us, free and clear, ready to get your troop back on its feet. All you had to do was teach us about your trade. You'd rather break the deal and insult a garista. So, you have a comfortable year, you stupid clown. As soon as it's over, you'll see us again. Come on, Lucaza.
She turned sharply, and Locke, supporting her act wholeheartedly, favored Moncrane with a sour smirk before he did the same.
Wait! Jasmer hissed. What's the name of the noble you struck?
Sabatha didn't give him any more time to think or plead or stew. She whirled on him just as quickly as she'd pretended to leave.
"Bulidazi," said Moncrain. "Baron Bulidazi of Palazzo Corsala."
"Why did you do it?"
"I was drinking," said Moncrain. He came down to Gloriano's. He wanted to buy out my debts, install himself as the company's patron."
"For this you punched him in the teeth?" said Locke. "What are you going to do if we get you out of here? Try to cut our hearts out?"
"Bulidazi's an ass, a stuck-up little ass. He's barely older than you, and he thinks he can buy and sell me like God's damned furniture. A theatrical company with his name on everything, wouldn't that be sweet? It took me 20 years to build my own troupe. I won't be anyone's hard man again. I'll take the Weeping Tower to that any day, any year."
"How was assaulting him preferable to letting him save your troop?"
said Sabitha. She sounded as incredulous as Locke felt.
"He doesn't care about the troop," said Moncrain. "He wants it mounted on his wall like a fucking hunting trophy. He wants some charity project he can dangle at whatever gilded cunt he's chasing to show what a sensitive and artistic fellow he is. I refuse to sell my good name to help rich puppies dip their wicks."
"What good name?" said Locke. "Even the members of your own company want to see you get eaten by a bear."
"And I'd be glad to supply one," said Sabitha. "Unfortunately for everyone, we're still going to rescue you. So I want you to sit quietly in your cell and bite your tongue."
"Tomorrow," said Locke, "this Baron Bulidazi will forgive your insult and decline to make charges."
"What?"
said Moncrain.
"Boy, listen to me. Even if Bulidazi had 1,000 cocks in his breeches and you blew every last one like a flute from sunrise to sunset..."
"He'll forgive your insult," said Sabitha through gritted teeth, "because that is the only possible salvation we can arrange for you. Understand? We have no other cards to play. So this is how it'll be. Once you're out, we'll discuss what you need to get your Republic of Thieves back into production."
"The trouble with this fantasy, girl, is that it requires both of us to not be mad," said Moncrain softly.
"All it requires is that you shut up and behave," said Sabitha. "And my name isn't Girl. Most times you can call me Verena Galante, but when I'm on stage, you'll call me Amadine."
"Will I?" Moncrain laughed. "That's a presumption a few steps ahead of my grasp. You show me your mythical thread of kindness in Bulidazi, then we'll chat on the matter of plays."
"Go back to your cell," said Sabitha. "I guarantee we'll speak again tomorrow."
5. "Even if we get him out," said Locke, "we'll need to put that man on a leash."
"He's a menace to himself and the rest of us," said Sabitha. "When we spring him, we should crowd him. Make it clear that he's being watched and judged at all times.
By the way, who's Amadine?"
"The best role in the Republic of Thieves," said Sabitha, grinning.
"I haven't read any of it yet."
"You should, before all the good parts get snapped up.
Someone kept it to herself all the way here."
"Moncrain's got to have more copies of it somewhere in his troop's mess. Janora might know. But first, we've got our miracle to deliver on."
"Miracle indeed," said Locke. They were moving back down the Legion steps, through the still ranks of the marble soldiers. The drizzle had let up, but there were soft rumbles of thunder from above. "We need to reach this Bulidazi, more or less as we are, and convince him to forgive one of the craziest assholes I've ever met for a completely unjustified drunken assault."
"Any ideas?"
Maybe. "Spit them out. I managed to shut Jasmine up long enough to make our point. I've earned my day's pay." "And you were a pleasure to watch, too," said Locke. "But then, you're always..."
"You do not have the time to be charming,"
said Sabitha, giving him a mild punch to the shoulder. "And I certainly don't have time to be charmed."
"Right, sure," said Locke. "We need an angle of approach. Why should he open his door for us?
Hey, what if we were Komori nobles going incognito?"
"Hiding in Aspara," she said, clearly liking the notion. "Trouble at home?"
No. No, if we're not in favor at home, we can't offer him anything. We might actually be a risk to him."
"You're right. Okay, you and I are cousins," said Sabitha. First cousins. Cousins, said Locke. So many goddamned imaginary cousins. You and I are cousins, if we have to show Jean and the Sanders their family retainers. We are, grandchildren of an old count that doesn't get out much.
Blackspear, said Sabatha. Enrico Battaglio, Count Blackspear. I was a scullery maid in his house a few years ago, that summer you spent on the farm.
A Five Towers family, said Locke. Would we live in the tower ourselves?
Yeah, most of his family does. And he hasn't been out of the city in 20 years.
He's as old as Duke Necovante. I'll be the daughter of his oldest son, and you're the son of his youngest. He has no other children. Oh, your father's dead, by the way. Fell off a horse 2 years ago.
Good to know. If we need any real details of the household, I'll pass the game to you whenever I can.
Locke snapped his fingers. We're in Aspara because you want to indulge your wish to be on stage,
which could never be allowed under my real name in Camorra.
Sabatha had never finished one of his thoughts before, in the way that Jean did all the time. Locke felt a flush of warmth.
That's great, she went on, heedless. So we're incognito, but with our family's permission.
Thus, whoever helps us makes himself a powerful and wealthy friend in Camorra.
Locke couldn't help smiling at the improbable thought that they might have found a way out after all.
Sabatha, this is great. It's also the thinnest line of bullshit we've ever hung ourselves on.
And we haven't even been here a full day yet.
We need given names.
There we can be lazy. I'm Verina Battaglio, you're Lucasa Battaglio.
Hells, yes!
Locke glanced around, affirming that they were still within the limited corridor of Aspara he'd managed to half-familiarize himself with.
We should head back to Gloriano's and see how they did with the horses. Then we can go visit this bully Darzi and beg him not to think too hard about where we've come from.
6. Orlando's cousin was as good as promised, said Jean. He waved at a young man, a bearded and heavier version of Orlando, who was sitting against the wall at the back of Gloriano's common room, accompanied by Orlando, Sylvanus, the Sanzas, and several half-empty bottles. Nobody else new or unknown was in the room.
He got us just over a royal apiece for the horses. All it cost us was a couple bottles of wine. And, I promised we'd give him a part in the play.
What?
No lines. He just wants to dress up and get stabbed, he says.
Just as long as he doesn't expect to get paid, said Sabatha.
Not in anything except hangovers, said Jean. I do notice you haven't dragged a large Siresti impresario back with you.
That game's afoot, said Locke.
Come, spill your purse. Asino brothers, on your feet a moment. We'd have a word concerning finance.
Oh, let them stay, said Sylvanus. This is the fun side of the room, and our young hostler was about to take hoof for more wine.
You're not finished with the 3 bottles you have, said Locke.
They're writing farewell notes to their families, said Sylvanus. Their holes are already dug in the ground. Oh, I suppose I really must get up before I piss, mustn't I?
He rolled sideways in the vague direction of the door that led back to the soaked innyard.
Give us a hand, hostler, give us a hand. I shall go on all fours to make use of your expertise.
Marvellous, said Locke, pulling Carlo and Galdo to their feet. Lovely. Are you two following Sylvanus down the vomit-strewn path?
We may be sociably fuzzed, said Carlo.
A little blurry at the edges, said Galdo.
That's probably for the best. I need you to come over here and dump out your purses.
You need us to do what now?
We need a flash bag, said Sabatha.
What the hell's a flash bag? Said Genora, wandering by at a moment precisely calculated to overhear what the huddled gentleman bastards were up to.
Since you ask, said Jean, it's a purse of coins you throw together to make it look like you're used to carrying around big fat sums.
Oh, she said, that must be a nice thing to have.
Using a spare table, the 5 Camorri dumped out their personal funds, to which Jean added the take from the horses and Locke mixed in the remnants of the purse chains had given them. Camorri barons, tyrans, and solons clattered against Esparan fifths and coppins.
Get all the coppers out of the pile, said Locke.
They're as useless as an Asino, brother. Suck vinegar from my ass crack, said Carlo. 5 pairs of hands sifted through the coins, pulling coppers aside, leaving a diminished but gleaming mass in the center. Copper gets split 5 ways, so everyone's got something, said Locke. Gold and silver goes in the purse.
Do you want Auntie to change any of that Komori stuff for you? Said Janora, peering over Jean's right shoulder.
No, said Locke. For the moment, it's actually a point in our favor. What's the flash count?
5 crowns, 2 tyrans, said Sabatha, and 2 royals, 1/5. That's more money than any of Auntie's customers have seen in a long time, said Janora.
It's shy of what I want, said Locke, but it might be convincing. No journeyman actor carries around 1.5 years' pay.
Unless they're not getting paid a damn thing, said Janora.
We'll deal with that tomorrow, said Locke as he cinched the flash bag tightly closed. Hopefully with Mon Crane listening very attentively.
Where are you going now? Said Jean.
To see Mon Crane's punching bag, said Sabatha. And if that Seresti son of a bitch can teach us better acting than what we'll need to pull this off, he'll actually deserve this rescue.
Want an escort? Said Jean.
Based on what you've seen tonight, muttered Locke, who needs it more, Sabatha and me or the twins?
Good point.
Jean polished his optics against the collar of his tunic and readjusted them on his nose.
I'll keep them out of trouble and see if I can trick Sylvanus into sleeping indoors.
Where's Palazzo Corsala? Said Sabatha to Janora. That's on the north side, the swell district. Can't miss it. Clean streets, beautiful houses, people like Sylvanus and Jasmer beaten on sight.
We'll spring for a hard coach, said Locke. We won't look respectable enough without one.
Shall we go call on Baron Bulidazi, then? Said Sabatha.
Yes, said Locke. No, wait. We've forgotten one terribly important thing. Let's run back up to Stay Awake Salvard and hope he's still feeling sympathetic. 7.
Tradesfolk entrances around back,
growled the tree trunk of a man who opened Bulidazi's front door.
Tradesfolk hours are...
What kind of tradesman hires a coach and 4 to make his rounds? Said Locke, jerking a thumb over his shoulder. Their hard carriage was waiting beyond the rows of alchemically miniaturized olive trees that screened Bulidazi's manor from the street. The driver hadn't liked their clothes, but their silver had vouched for them quite adequately.
Pray give your master this, said Sabatha, holding out a small white card.
This had been scrounged from the office of Stairwake Salvard, who had bemusedly agreed to charge them a few coppins for it and some ink. The servant glanced at the card, glared at them, then glanced at the card again.
Wait here,
he said, and closed the door. Several minutes went by. The slow drip of water from the canvas awning above their head became a soft, steady drumbeat as the rain picked up again. At last the door creaked open, and a rectangle of golden light from inside the house fell over them.
Come,
said the bulky servant. 2 more men waited behind him, and for an instant Locke feared an ambush. However, these servants wielded nothing more threatening than towels, which they used to wipe Locke and Sabatha's shoes dry. Baron Bulidazi's house was unexceptional, among those of its type that Locke had seen. It was comfortable enough, furnished to show off disposable wealth, but there was no grand and special something, no hall piece, as they were often called, to evoke wonder from freshly arrived guests. The servant took them out of the foyer, through a sitting hall, and into a warmly lit room with felt-padded walls. A blandly handsome man of about 20, with neck-length black hair and close-set dark eyes, was leaning against a billiards table with a stick in his hands. The white card was on the table.
The Honorable Verena Bottaglio and companion,
said the servant without enthusiasm. He left the room immediately.
Of the Isle Zantara? Said Bulidazi more warmly. I've just read your card. Isn't that part of the Alcigrante?
It is, Lord Bulidazi, said Sabatha, giving the slight nod and half-curtsy that was usual in Camor for an informal, noble reception.
Have you ever been there?
To Camor? No. I've always wanted to visit, but I've never had the privilege.
Lord Bulidazi, said Sabatha, may I present my cousin, the Honorable Lucasa Bottaglio?
Your cousin, eh?
Said Bulidazi, nodding as Locke bowed his head. The Asparan lord offered his hand.
As they shook, Locke noted that Bulidazi was solidly built, much the same size as Alondo's hostler cousin, and he didn't hold back the strength in his grip.
"Thank you for receiving us," said Locke. "We would have both sent our cards, but only Verena is carrying one, I'm afraid."
"Oh, you weren't robbed or anything, I suppose? Is that why you've come dressed as you are? Forgive my mentioning it."
"No, we haven't been mistreated," said Sabatha. "And there's nothing to forgive. We're not traveling in our usual capacity. We're incognito, with just a bodyguard and a pair of servants, though we've left them behind for the moment."
"Incognito," said Bulidazi. "Are you in some sort of danger?"
"Not in the slightest," said Sabatha with a laugh.
She then turned and feigned surprise. Locke was confident that only long familiarity allowed him to spot the fact that it was a willful change, at the sight of a saber resting in its scabbard on a witchwood display shelf.
"Is that what I think it is?"
"What exactly do you think it is?" said Bulidazi,
and it seemed to Locke that he was a touch more curt than before.
"Surely it's a Devorus, the seal on the hilt."
"It is," said Bulidazi, instantly losing his tone of impatience. "One of his later blades, but still..."
"I trained with a Devorus," said Sabatha, poising one hand above the hilt of the saber. "The Voilante Bona rapier. Don't get me wrong, it wasn't mine, my instructor's. I still remember the balance and the patterns in the steel. Your hilt looks honorably stained. I assume you practice with it?"
"Often," said Bulidazi. "This one's called Dracovilus. It's been in my family for 3 generations. It suits my style. Not the fastest on the floor, but when I do move, I can put a bit of strength behind it."
"The saber rewards a sturdy handler," said Sabatha.
"We're neglecting your cousin," said Bulidazi. "Forgive me, Lucaza. Please don't allow my enthusiasms to shove you aside from the conversation."
"Not at all, Lord Bulidazi. I've had my years with the fencing masters, of course, but Verena's the connoisseur in the family."
Bulidazi's heavy servant returned and whispered into the baron's ear. Locke silently counted to 10 before the servant finished. The big man withdrew again, and the baron stared at Locke.
"You know, I just now recall," he said. "Bottaglio, isn't that one of the 5 Towers clans?"
"Of course," said Sabatha.
"And yet you give your address as the Isla Zantara," said Bulidazi.
"I'm fond of grandfather," said Sabatha. "But surely you can understand how someone my age might prefer a little manner of her own."
"And your grandfather?" said Bulidazi expectantly.
"Don Enrico Battaglio."
"Better known as Count Blackspear?"
said Bulidazi, still cautiously.
"Verena's father is Blackspear's eldest son," said Locke. "I'm the son of his youngest."
"Oh, I believe I might have heard something of your father, Lucaza," said the baron. "I do hope that he is well."
Locke felt a surge of relief that they'd pretended to be from a family Sabatha had knowledge of. Bulidazi obviously had access to some sort of directory of Camorri peers. Locke allowed himself to look crestfallen for just an instant, and then put on an obviously forced smile.
"I'm sorry," he said, "but I must inform you that my father died 7 years ago.
"Oh," said Bulidazi, visibly relaxing. "Forgive me. I must have been thinking of someone else. But why didn't the pair of you simply give the name of the Count when you—"
"Noble cousin," said Sabatha, shifting instantly into her excellent throne Therin, "the name of Blackspear commands instant attention in Camor, but surely you wouldn't think us so vulgar as to try and awe you with it in Aspara, as the freshest of acquaintances, as guests in your house?"
"Oh, vulgar? Oh, no, never," said Bulidazi in the same language.
Anyone of breeding was expected to endure years of tutelage in it, and he'd clearly done his time in the purgatory of conjugation and tenses.
"I didn't mean that I expected anything uncouth of you."
"Lord Bulidazi," said Locke, returning the conversation to plain Therin, "we're the ones who should be apologizing for imposing ourselves upon you in our present state. We have our reasons, but you needn't regret being cautious."
"I'm glad you understand," said the baron. "Time on!"
The large servant, who must have been lurking just past the door, stepped inside.
"It's all right, Timon," said the baron. "I think our guests will be staying for a while. Let's have some chairs."
"Of course, my lord," said the servant,
relaxing out of his cold and intimidating aspect as easily as removing a hat.
"I hope you don't mind if we talk in here," said Bulidazi. "My parents, well, it was just last year. I can't really think of the study as my room quite yet."
"I know how it is," said Locke. "You inherit the memories of a house as well as its stones. I didn't touch anything in my father's library for months."
"I suppose I should call you Don and Donna Bottaglio, then," said the Baron.
"Only if you want to flatter us," said Locke with a smile.
"Well, Grandfather still holds the title," said Sabatha. "My father, as direct heir, is called Don. But since we're two steps removed, we are at present just a pair of honorables."
Timon returned, along with the shoe towelers, and three high-backed chairs were set down next to the billiards table. Bulidazi seemed reasonably convinced of their authenticity now, and Locke felt a pang of mingled awe and anxiety. Here was a lord of the city, capable of putting them in prison, or worse, with a word, opening to their false facing like any common shopkeeper, guard, or functionary. Chains was right. Their training had given them a remarkable freedom of action. Still, it seemed wise to seal the affair as tightly as possible.
"Gods above," said Locke, "what a boor I've been. Lord Bulidazi, forgive me. Is it usual in Aspara to give a consideration to house servants? Damn!"
Locke pulled out his purse and made what he thought was an excellent show of stumbling toward the withdrawing Timon. He fell against the billiards table, and a stream of clinking gold and silver just happened to scatter across the felt surface.
"Are you all right?"
The Baron was at Locke's side in an instant, helping him up, and Locke was satisfied that Bulidazi had a full view of the coins.
"Fine, thank you. I'm such a clumsy ass. You can see all the grace in the family wound up on Verena's side."
Locke swept the coins back into the purse. "Sorry about your game."
"It was just a solitary diversion," said Bulidazi, as he helped Sabatha into a chair. "And yes, on holidays we do give gratuities to the help. But there's a little ceremony and some temple nonsense. You needn't worry about it."
"Well, we're obliged to you," said Locke, relieved that he could escape without surrendering any of the flashbag funds. All Bulidazi had to do was believe that money was no real object to them.
"Now," said Sabatha, "I suppose you'd like to find out why we've come to you."
"Of course," said Bulidazi. "But first, why not tell me what it would please you to be called, if not Donna Bottaglio?"
"That's easy," said Sabatha, flashing a smile that hit Locke like a boot to the chest, even though he wasn't positioned to catch its full effect. "You should call me Verena."
"Verena," said the Baron. "Then I beg that you'll call me Gennaro, and let no more Lord Bulidazi's clutter the air between us."
"With pleasure," said Sabatha. "Gennaro," said Locke, "we're here to discuss the situation of a man named Jasmamon Crane."
"What?"
"To put it even more plainly," said Sabatha, "we've come to ask that you decline to state your charges against him."
"You want me to forgive him?"
"Or appear to," said Sabatha sweetly.
"That arrogant pissant struck me before witnesses," said Bulidazi, "with the back of his hand. You can't expect me to believe that a Camorri would bear such a thing, were either of you in my place."
"If I had nothing to win by a display of mercy," said Locke, "I'd have whipped the stupid bastard's face into bloody mince. And if none of us stood to gain right now, I'd go to court with you merely for the pleasure of hearing the sentence read."
"We're not strangers to Moncrane," said Sabatha. "We've been to see him at the Weeping Tower."
"Why?"
"Please," said Sabatha, "just listen. We know what a fool he is. We're not here to discuss the brighter facets of his character, because we know he doesn't have any, and we're not asking for mercy for its own sake. We'd like to propose a mutually profitable arrangement."
"How could I possibly profit," said Bulidazi, "by accepting disgrace in front of the entire city?"
"First, tell us, were you serious about wanting to fund Moncrane's troop and buy out his debts?" said Locke.
"I was," said the Baron. "I certainly was, until he decided to thank me by lunging at me like an ape."
"Why did you make the offer?"
"I grew up attending his plays," said Bulidazi. "Mother loved the theatre. Moncrane really used to be something back before, well, years ago."
"And you wanted to be a patron," said Locke.
All my family money is sitting safe in vaults, gathering dust and shitting interest. I thought I'd do something meaningful for a change. Pick Moncrane up, run things properly, associate my name with something. Bulidazi drummed his fingers against one arm of his chair. What the hell can Moncrane possibly mean to you?
I came here to be part of his troop for the summer, said Sabatha. I have a certain inclination. It's awkward to talk about myself, though. Lucasa, would you?
Of course, said Locke.
Cousin Varina has always loved the theatre, as much of it as she could get in Camor. Grandfather's hired players a dozen times for her, but she's always wanted to be on stage, to act, and that's just not done. If I'd taken up alchemy, said Sabatha, or gardening, or painting, or investment, that'd be fine. I could even ride off to war, if we had ever had any. But noble heirs don't go on stage, not in Camor.
Not if they want to inherit, said Locke, and grandfather won't be with us forever. After him it's uncle, and after uncle it's Varina.
Countess Blackspear, eh? Said Bulidazi.
Whether or not we keep Blackspear is up to the Duke. The Five Towers are his to dispose of, but our lands wouldn't go anywhere. If Blackspear was rescinded, I'd be Countess of the old family estates.
So you've come here posing as an actress to avoid the scandal in Camor.
You understand perfectly, said Sabatha. Varina Galante can have a summer or two on stage in Espara, and then Varina Bottaglio can go back to being respectable back home. That's the bargain I struck with Father, also provided Lucasa and a few trusted men came along to keep an eye on me.
And that's the understanding we had with Moncrane, said Locke. We'd furnish several actors, and he'd make use of us in a play. Imagine our surprise when we arrived this afternoon to discover the situation.
Imagine my surprise when Moncrane attacked me, said Bulidazi. You're putting me between two fires, my friends. I can protect my dignity according to the laws and customs of Espara, or I can grant this request, to which I would normally be very happily disposed. I can't do both.
If you withdrew from chastising Moncrane out of cowardice or indifference, said Sabatha, then I agree, your behavior would be improper. But what if your peers could see that you had forgiven him for the sake of a greater design?
Mercy, said Locke, bringing his hands slowly together as though squeezing his words into one mass as he spoke them.
Ambition, artistry, and good old-fashioned financial sense, all at once.
Moncrane wants nothing to do with me, said Bulidazi, and I'm pleased to return the sentiment. Let the bastard rot for a year and a day. Maybe he'll grow some discretion when he loses his hand.
I don't have a year and a day, Gennaro, said Sabatha.
Then why not see Basanti? He's the success. Built his own theatre, even. I'm sure he'd put you on stage in a heartbeat. You're certainly,
Yes?
You'd certainly have a great many eyes following you attentively, if you'll pardon my boldness.
Pardon gladly extended. But if Basanti's really the thing, why didn't you approach him about a partnership rather than Moncrane?
Basanti has no need of a bandage on his finances. Besides, there's nothing to build where he's concerned. It's hard to take credit for something already achieved.
Believe it or not, we feel much the same about Moncrane, said Sabatha. He's a means to an end. Forgive him, let him go free, and I guarantee he'll accept your patronage.
What makes you assume I'm still willing to offer it?
Come now, Gennaro, said Sabatha, deepening her voice a little, adopting a slightly teasing tone. Don't punish yourself for Moncrane's stupidity. Your plan was a good one.
If you help us in this, said Locke, you'll have him entirely in your power. Financial debt and moral debt, and you'll have us to keep him in line.
The Moncrane Bulidazi Company, said Sabatha.
Or the Bulidazi Moncrane Company, said Locke.
I'll look weak, said the Baron, but his voice had the wavering quality of a man nearly ready to go over the edge of the precipice they were nudging him toward.
You'll look clever, Locke said. Hells, you'll look like you might have planned the whole thing all along to stir up notice.
That's marvelous, said Sabatha. At the end of the summer, after we've whipped satisfaction out of Moncrane, you let slip that the whole affair was just a ploy for attention. That's the payoff for a little bit of pain in court tomorrow.
Basanti will be forgotten in a moment, and all the city's admiration will settle on what you've done.
You'll look like a bloody genius, said Locke, immensely pleased with himself.
The Bulidazi Moncrane Company, said the Baron. It does have a certain weight, a certain noble ring to it.
Help me have a season or two in the lights, said Sabatha, then bring the company touring to Camor. We'll introduce you to Grandfather, all the counts and countesses, the Duke.
They could play all the Five Towers in turn, said Locke, the rooftop gardens. Verena and I would have to disappear as actors, of course, but we'd be delighted to attend the shows as your hosts.
Isn't that worth temporary inconvenience? Said Sabatha with a smile that could have coaxed steam out of ice.
I will require a moment to reflect, said Bulidazi.
Shall we leave you alone? Said Sabatha, rising part way from her chair.
Yes, but for a moment. Timon will fetch you anything you desire in the reception hall.
Locke rose as well, but Bulidazi held up a hand.
Not you, Lucaza, if you please. I'd appreciate a word.
Locke sank back into his chair, stole a brief glance at Sabatha, and caught the slightest hint of a nod from her. She withdrew the way she and Locke had come.
Lucaza, said the Baron, leaning forward and lowering his voice, I hope that I might be forgiven this liberty. I know that Camori are not to be trifled with in matters touching family